Before this episode starts, I wanted to clarify one thing, and I didn't talk about this in the podcast, which was a mistake. Fair trade being super relevant right now is an important aspect of why I did this episode. Today, the coffee market, the C market, the commodities market side of it, is about 96 cents per pound. Cost of production for organic farmers is between $1.40 and $1.50 typically. So right now, most buyers that are buying green coffee, organic, 83 cup, 82 cup, are buying it based on a differential. So they pay, 20 to 30 cents over the C market, which means right now they're paying about $1.16, $2.30 to farmers, meaning that they're selling at a loss, the farmers are. With Fairtrade Organic, the minimum price standard is $1.90 per pound. So it sets that bottom level where producers are actually guaranteed to make some profit. So I just wanted to give you that quick information so that you have some context into this episode. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Cultivating Change with Martin Mayorga. Nikki's not here today. He's vacationing from all his hard work. I'm here today with Isabella Pacheco and Stephanie Westell from Fair Trade America. And we're here in Rockville at our facility here, so welcome.
Thank you.
I'm pretty sure most people that listen to this will have heard of Fair Trade and know of it. Hopefully they know a lot about it, but I'm not sure about that right now. So we'll dig into that. Can you talk a little bit about what Fair Trade is specifically?
Well, there's two parts to it. I mean, there is who we are, and then there's like part of our operation. It's actually more of a simple idea than it seems, because then the system itself gets a little complex. We are a nonprofit international organization that helps set standards and implementation of those standards to improve trade conditions for small-scale farmers and also labor workers. The other part to us, I mean, that's our very general way to describe all that we do. There are three parts to our system and who we are. There is our most important part, which is our producer networks. We have a producer network in Latin America, one in Africa, and one in Asia. And they're the boots on the ground. They're the ones who provide direct help and help farmers get organized into co-ops and get educational and all the materials and the way they use the premium. Now that we talk about the premium goes the other part. The setup of the standards happen in our brain, which is our headquarters in Germany. There's where the studies of living income happen, all that good stuff to set up workable standards. There's 50% of the board there and making the decisions is also farmer represented. And then there's us. There are about 24 offices worldwide like us, which are national initiatives. We are part of the system. We help fund the system, and we are responsible for increasing awareness and also helping farmers get more business within the developed world.
Okay.
And I'm gonna just add one more thing to Issa's comment, is that the future of fair trade is really looking to partnerships. So that's gonna be the fourth tier, and where you see the fair trade movement go as a global nonprofit is really partnering with brands, because we can't do this alone. This is definitely a collaborative effort moving forward.
Okay, and so you guys are on the third tier, essentially. You guys are here in D.C.
Yes, trying to create those partnerships, basically, through awareness and through the help of getting companies here in the developed, because it's not only in the States. We have offices in Canada. We have offices all throughout Europe, in Australia, New Zealand, trying to get companies to realize the worth of paying a just price, improving the living conditions of these farmers in order to get a sustainable crop or commodity to work.
It makes sense. And it's what we care about, too, as a company, why I'm in this mess. So one of the things that I think, at least people in the industry that have seen, there's now two fair trade organizations, Fair Trade America and Fair Trade USA. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in an easy way for consumers to understand?
Sure. So I think I'll take the first part of this.
Okay.
And when you're in a grocery store, there's so many different labels that maybe just say fair trade, direct trade, and it gets a little bit of a greenwashing. And so the biggest difference that as a consumer, as you're seeing the label, Fair Trade America is actually a division of Fair Trade International. Fair Trade International is what actually makes the standards, does all of the in-origin projects with our producer networks, and is where those partnerships actually really matter most, is because if you, without them, all of these things can't be implemented on the ground. When you are looking in the grocery store and you see a logo that has Fairtrade USA on it, those standards we can't talk to because they're actually not part of the Fairtrade International system.
And it's also good to point out, when you go to, it's not only Fairtrade USA, sadly, on the supermarket. There's Fair for Life, there's a bunch of other claims. The one part that for me it's very interesting and why they compare so much to Fairtrade USA is because Fairtrade USA at some point was part of the international system,
right,
when the international system was called Transfair. There was differences in basically methodologies of how they thought they could help the producer. We as a movement, the Fairtrade International movement, focuses on small scale farmers. We do believe that the farmer should have a voice within our development of standards, which are development of minimum pricing. Like, there should be a collaboration, not only because the two sides need to be represented, it also creates responsibility on both sides. The farmer needs to be helped and also is capable of being responsible for all these things and knows what's really happening on the ground more than anybody else. They're the ones there. And also, we need to give a voice for the business. I mean, that's kind of where we think our fair word comes. So there's basically, I think, to point out four key differences, and to answer actually your question, the differences. The first one is on the licensing that you pay, Fairtrade USA does not give back into the system, into the producer networks. We give 40% back of that. Then there is the part of our standard committees and our minimum pricing discussions. Our boards are 50% farmer represented. Their board is only business represented. Then we have the fact that we don't, trying to see how I can word this properly.
The premium.
Yes, the premium for certain commodities is not the same.
Right.
So for example, with bananas, when we were in Colombia, I think telling you this story earlier, the label Fairtrade USA only gives 50 cents per box premium, while we have established a $1. And they've come up with the idea that this helps them sell more and ends up creating them more money, but the premium shouldn't be something we don't agree with, the premium being played with.
Right.
So that's kind of our big key things. We don't work with any big farms. We work with small scale farmers.
So is it mostly co-ops and then small scale farms themselves?
So we require all farmers to become part of a co-op or create co-ops. And we don't, co-ops sometimes in different countries mean different things. So that's kind of a term that we have to play with. They're also democratic associations.
Right.
Basically, it's the way for us to audit and for the money to be managed in better ways. If they have to vote equally to use the sourcing of the fair trade premium, which is something I guess we should explain in a little bit later, then they have to. If it's decided democratically, then it's easier for that to be controlled versus somebody making the decision of how that money is used.
Makes sense. So let's talk about the premium. You know, I think number one is understanding what that premium is and represents to the producer. And then I think I would like to understand the, you know, how you guys figure out what the best price paid to the farmer is. I mean, what's happening right now in coffee is very confusing because unfortunately, it takes a really bad situation for people to become aware of certain things. And I think because the coffee market, the commodities market's so low, you're getting a lot of press about the issues that it can create to the small disadvantaged, you know, more remote producers who are actually more dependent on the sea market because they don't have access to, right. to the actual
right.
market. But I think what it's done is created more opportunity for more noise to emerge, like people using fair trade and not really being affiliated with any certifier. Direct trade, which just means direct trade. I mean, it can mean a million different things.
And it doesn't guarantee what they're paying, or it doesn't
or
talk
who they're
about
paying it to,
yeah, exactly.
or whether it's an actual. I mean, for, I would argue all day long that most direct trade deals are made with either brokers and traders or family estates that don't really need the money. They're just savvy enough to put themselves in an industry where there's a spotlight on those things. So how do you guys determine the price point, the premiums, and how do you determine that?
So with every commodity, it's a little bit different. We can give you the most recent example, which is in cocoa, which has also been in the press a little bit lately.
Okay.
So within cocoa, we have a what we call a price review within our standards about every 2 years or so. And so with this, it brings together not only producers, but traders, brands, and people within the Fairtrade International system itself. So everyone comes to the table, and then they discuss what is actually a fair price. Now, going a little further into that is like a living wage,
right?
Which we are, with the cocoa minimum price being where it's gonna be in October of 2019, it still will not meet that living wage requirement.
Right.
And a lot of times the press comes back with, well, if you're not even meeting a living wage, how did this pricing even come about? And the shortest answer to give is that you can't shock the market right away. You can't just go from a 2,000.
Amen, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what the issue right now I'm seeing with
exactly.
these small companies making big claims about paying $3, $4 a pound for coffee. You know, A, they're doing it in very small volumes, and B, we have to recognize that, you know, and I think the word fair is a very important one because we have to be fair to the consumer, and we have to recognize that we're in a marketplace. Whether we love how it's structured or not, it has to make sense within the context of a marketplace.
Right.
I think, was it Ghana recently that tried to set a minimum?
As a country, yes.
As a country, and they really hurt them. They had a hard time really, you know, transacting because you know, they maybe overreached a little bit on pricing. And so, you know, I just wanted to interject that to your point because
yeah.
I think a lot of people are like, well, why don't you just make everybody pay, make them pay $2 a pound, make them pay $3 a pound.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think we have to walk into the solution. You know, we have to recognize in coffee, at least, this is a 300-year-old problem.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to fix it in 5 or 10 years,
right.
unfortunately. I'd love to fix it in 6 months, but
yeah.
it's going to take generations probably, unfortunately, to really make a difference. I think we can make a big difference now, but to really bake it into the marketplace and into society,
mm-hmm.
it's going to take a long time. So
oh, definitely. And I think that like brands being leaders within their own commodities and pushing each other is going to really make it go quicker.
I agree completely. So we took a little break because I had to make sure I was actually recording since Nikki's not here. But so far, so good. So, where were we?
We were talking about how premiums and minimum pricing and
mm-hmm.
living wages, how that goes about. Steph was giving us the example of cocoa, which is the most recent one that has had adjustments.
And maybe we should kind of back up for some people who maybe are newer to the fair trade movement or just want a quick refresher and how the actual minimum price and premium work within the system.
Right. So our standards have, we base our standards on three pillars. A lot of people think that we're only about the commodity pricing and how much money the farmer gets, but we actually have three pillars, and it includes an environmental one, an economic, and a social. The environmental, yes, it's focused on not only making sure the farmer is versed on better practices for the environment, but also for themselves. So we sometimes forget how much exposure to chemicals, to the way that those are handled in order not to contaminate their animals or their families or the community. And so we've developed not only programs to teach them how to do more organic fertilizers or better usage of the seeds and quality of the seeds, but also how to keep these chemicals and how to reduce the amount, and for them to also understand what it's doing to the soil. On coffee, we have a whole new guidelines on how to use the aguas mieles and how that is used to process and create more fertilizing instead of just giving that to waste or just putting dumping that and contaminating water. Right. And then we have the economic aspect. And the way we do this is by setting up minimum pricing for a commodity. And I think something that confuses people is that they think that the minimum price is, and I guess it's because of their of its name, it's something, it's like the price that they should be paying. It's like the fair price, and it's not. A minimum price is supposed to only be a safety net. Basically, when something really goes wrong, like the market really dropping, it's supposed to be a proxy for cost of production. So it's a way to set up a, an amount so people know what they should be paying, and it should be above cost, because if not, the farmer is not right. making anything, which means it's not going to be sustainable and they're not going to keep growing it. Aside from that, we have something called fair trade premium, and that's where the social pillar comes into play. We believe the farmer should have the autonomy of deciding what to do with that money, but of course we give them somewhat guidelines and within what they can use that money for. And it's usually related to not only improving their productivity as a co-op or democratic association, but also improving the living conditions of them and their community. We have a really good example of a wine company in Argentina called La Riojana. They were really poor, very isolated. They had no running water. They started with setting up running water systems and setting up a water tank for themselves. And that has developed into they got their organic certification after that. They started producing olive oil after that. Then they created a whole new school after that. They created a hot, like a little medical facility. So they are, you start realizing that you, just like if it would be you down there, you know what you need the most, and you just need a little bit of a push, and that's kind of where the fair trade premium comes into play.
Yeah, it's essentially, you know, if you have a job and you get a promotion or you get a raise or you get right. even a living wage raise, right. you know, you're then going to buy, you know, more food for your kids or maybe right. invest in private education, whatever your priorities right. are, and right. within the scope of being a responsible parent or, you know, a responsible
right.
adult making right. healthy decisions, so... one question I would have that I think a lot of, well, I'll ask you the broader question first and then. So what do we say to people that are, you know, the true capitalist that's going to say, well, you're setting price minimums and that's, you know, let competition decide how things go and what, you know, what producer's fate might be. And if they're producing for under their cost of production, then that's their problem. They're, because there is that harshness. I mean, I've yes. been doing this 22 years, and you know, one of the things that is very unfortunately real for me is that I'm in the middle, right? I was small. I started very small. I still have the mindset of a small kind of startup every day. I try to think like a small startup. But we also have scale. So I get to see both sides. I see the big commercial side saying, look, you know what? We can make money. We're making money. You know, we're putting the returns to our investors. We're giving returns to our, you know, our shareholders. And, you know, then you have the smaller, well, let's address first that, because then the smaller part, I think, is a separate conversation. How do you address that, you know, when people say, look, you know, capitalism is capitalism. You know, you can't set a minimum on things, and it'll actually, I've heard the argument, too, that setting a standard pricing model will hurt quality in the long run, will hurt the farmer in the long run, because they'll be incentivized to grow more volume of lower quality.
I actually love this question, yes. so I'll take it.
Go for it.
And I love this question because there are so many companies right now who are either benefit corps or, you know, you could call them a social enterprise, who are actually disproving this.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that they're disproving this is because of their using their supply chains as not a supply chain, but a supply community.
Right.
And they really treat the farmers and the actors within that supply community as employees. And as a corporation, you're set up, or company LLC, to provide a job, as well as you're investing in the people that you want to see your company grow with. And if you don't have the inputs at the start, you're never going to have it in the end. And I think it's a sustainability piece as well.
So do you think, and maybe you can't answer this, so I'll answer it for you after. Do you think the fate of the big commercial companies paying and taking advantage of the C market is gloomy in the fact that they're not curating a supply chain, they're not curating partnerships, yeah. They're fully transactional, they're dehumanizing a very human supply chain?
Exactly. Well, I don't think, we start by thinking like, the coffee we're drinking, most of it, is something that's very hands-on. Same with cocoa, same mm-hmm. with a lot of the commodities that are big. Dehumanizing does take into consideration the change of the quality that you're getting. If you start harvesting with machines, for example, which in a lot of the terrains that coffee is grown, it's very, very hard to do,
just
for starters. Mm-hmm. But if, let's say, you have a big plantation and you invest in the machinery, you are not going to have the curated picking of the right ripe cherries. You're not. So you are, in basis, yes, you might increase volumes, but you're also blending it out.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to have varieties. We're not going to have quality differences. And I like my coffee very different from, I'm sure, the coffee you like, and then that's going to be gone, basically.
Well, I'm sure you like Mayorga, so we probably share that. So let's think about the flip side then, because another thing that I'm having is this very big like rubber band effect, where now people are seeing this rubber band stretch to like the commercial people are just, you know, the bad guy,
right.
And now we're going to be the good guy by doing the exact opposite to the extreme, which is we pay, you know, $4 a pound for this curated, you know, specialty micro lot. But the presentation you see in these mm-hmm. segments of the hyper specialty, you know, just I want to make it clear, they call themselves specialty.
Right.
They're specialty, but so are we. The specialty is 80 plus cup.
Right.
Until that changes, you know, I fight that because, you know, people refer to the small as specialty.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, small doesn't mean better. Small doesn't mean quality. And specialty is a standard that we operate very well in and have been for 22 years. But how do you address that, and you meaning us as an industry, where now I think there's, and I've argued with people that the hyper specialty movement maybe has hurt more than helped the coffee industry, because it's created a fake band-aid,
right.
Of, well, people look at different companies and websites and say, well, they're paying $3.50 a pound, $4 a pound. That's mm-hmm. three times the fair trade minimum, whatever they want to use as a quantification. You know, my perspective is, number one, the volumes are tiny. Number two, that's been verified to me, because most farmers tell me that it's a pain in the ass to produce 3 to 4% of your crop under very strict guidelines for a very demanding consumer or customer that's buying 3 to 4% of your crop. And lastly, the producers who can afford to curate that level of quality are not poor. I would challenge any, you know, unless they just want to pay what I think are irresponsible prices because they're not sustainable in the industry and they're not scalable, for just being a nice guy. That's great. That's nice. But at least say that. Look, you know, we're buying a good coffee and we're paying $1.50 more just out of the kindness of our hearts, which I think is more, I appreciate and respect more than claiming that your coffee is 100 times better just because you were dumb enough to overpay for it. And you
right.
probably paid a trader.
But you said two key things. You said,
I think I said like 10 key things.
No, but to answer your question, one, and I think the main one for us is, as an organization that's trying to help the small-scale farmer, as an organization that's trying to push that up, is the small-scale farmer doesn't have the room to create these micro amazing lots just because they don't have the resources for it.
Right.
So if you want to do, I mean, I'm sure there is a market and a niche, and if they're doing it, it's because people are paying for it and it's great. Our problem with that is you can't qualify that as you trying to break the poverty cycle. You're not aiding that.
I agree.
By doing that.
You have to have scale. You have to have volume.
Exactly.
And I think we were talking earlier, and you gave a stat that 80% of coffee grown comes right. from small impoverished producers.
No. 80% of coffee farmers are small-scale farmers, which means 5 acres or less.
Gotcha. So a number of farmers.
Farmers, yes.
And that's significant because part of what is frustrating me right now is that a lot of people and companies are using all the press that's going on right now, which is due and which is right, which is mm-hmm. the fact that there's something systemically wrong with the C market. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is they're utilizing that. They're using the name and the plight of the truly impoverished small farmer and pretending to be addressing it by overpaying traders or already wealthy farmers.
Right.
So they're actually removing the farmers we care about as a company, you guys care about as an organization, they're moving them further away from the market. They're actually creating a new layer of noise and confusion for the consumer to now say to somebody like me who pays a good price, I'm not paying $3.50 a pound for coffee. I wouldn't have been able to grow a company to this size if I had. Now there are some coffees, you know, and actually we have some of it documented on our social media where I'll be meeting with a farmer and they're smart enough now when we do a live stream, they'll work my pricing, they'll negotiate pricing with me.
When you're on the record.
Yeah, when you're on the record. And I always agree because my philosophy is I don't negotiate with producers. They tell me what they want for their coffee and if I can sell it with that price structure, I sell it. You know, to their credit, I don't like saying customers' names on here, but there's one very good large customer mm-hmm. who's buying everything I bought out of Costa Rica. We're talking, I don't know, 50, 60,000 pounds of coffee that I paid $4.25 to the producer.
Ouch.
And this retailer is paying enough money for them to make money, for me to make money, for the consumer to get a good price. But that's rare,
you know.
And I can't, that's like a one-off for me. If I did that all the time, I wouldn't be able to scale. So what I need to do and what I believe in is, it's that 80-20 rule. You know, it's like, you're gonna make the biggest impact in that 80%. Of anything. And in my opinion, that 80%, and really in coffee it's 95% of the market. I'd rather take 2% of that 95% of the market and change people from commercial into a nice specialty at a good price, treating producers well and giving them better opportunity, than saying I'm gonna buy 0.25% of coffee at a great price.
Right.
So how are you guys, because I'm sure you're seeing that now with direct trade and with everybody having their own quote-unquote programs. I mean, I've seen fully fraudulent certifications that people put on their packaging. Like,
yeah, they create their own labels. They do all these.
Who's verifying this? Like, I thought about doing it, and I investigated. I'm like, for a third-party certification, like, it's just another audit that we have to go through, which is just already a daunting thing. And it's like, why create my own that has no brand equity when I could at least just partner with somebody if I'm going to go that certification route?
Right.
But how are you guys seeing that impact your movement and your impact? When now there's now another layer of noise that's affecting you.
Do you want?
Well,
yeah, I can take this one because I think it's really prevalent in chocolate right now. I think that a little bit of it has been some noise for sure. And that because we're already in such a crazy greenwashed grocery store, that consumers are just confused. But before I started at Fairtrade, I mean, I was one of those confused customers. I couldn't have listed every single label that was on chocolate or coffee or told you the mm-hmm. differences. It's just because of my day job now.
Yeah.
But what it really does hurt is it hurts the, like, keys, I guess, like, the key reason why third-party certification is so important. And it's that first word, third. We are the third party who's coming in as an unbiased person and saying to a consumer that yes, they are doing the right thing. Here are the certification checks. When the company takes it on their own hands, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not doing the right thing. Some of them are not, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. But it does mean that you as the consumer need to make that choice. Are you gonna support the company who is really trying to push these partnerships forward, who wants to have this third-party certification? Or are you gonna support somebody who might be doing the right thing, claiming it?
Right.
But there's a lot of gray right now.
Yeah.
And I know certification can be a pain in the butt when you get like all these, can we say pain in the butt here?
We can say pain in the ass.
Oh, okay. We don't say that at our office.
When we're talking about audits and taking the time for those, but they are a necessary evil. it's the only way that you get. We have basically the top-notch certifier. A lot of the labels accept our certifier. We only accept our certifier, and it's Flow Cert. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that was set up is in order, there's no interest there. Their interest is for the standards to be obliged. Then there's no extra money for them if they are or not. There's no, so if by setting that up, then you have some, again, the third party to verify it. That's what gives it value. We were discussing this before the recording. We're like, if you want to grow, you can't be your own police.
Yeah.
It's just you either focus on growing your business and getting selling more and getting more out there, which is ultimately, if you're doing it on fair trade terms, gonna help the farmer. So we want you to focus on that, and we want to be that. I hate saying the police person, but we want to be that person that checks for you to make sure that the investment you're doing is actually helping. We also need to have a bigger conversation as participants in this industry of the balance between having the farmer having its autonomy, because it's not only about certifying and checking that and checking the end. It's about checking the entire supply chain. So through us, every person that touches that coffee or that cocoa or those bananas will get certified in order to make sure that the premium is getting actually taken all the way to the producer, that the minimum price is actually getting down there. Like, and also the other way around, that it's fair for them, so that if you're buying something that is supposed to be in fair trade terms and you believe it's using less pesticides, it's helping the environment, you need to make sure that what you're paying is getting certified,
right?
So then you have the certainty when you put it on your label, then you're giving out a product with better quality and better terms.
Okay, and you know, this is probably a good time to bring up something I probably should have brought up in the beginning, is that right now we don't work under fair trade or with fair trade as a partnership. We have in the past, and we were doing some pretty good volume business in the
past.
And
you'll do it again. I'm getting you on the record.
You're learning from the farmer.
Yes.
Well, you know, for us it's been, and I've never been shy about, you know, there's a sense of autonomy I like. There's a sense of I don't like authority. Maybe I'm arrogant. Maybe I feel like I know more than most people, which I still can tell you I do believe is true, about how to really work with producers well. Because that's why I started this business. You know, like I tell people, we sell more coffee to support our farmers. Most people support farmers to sell coffee. Meaning, I got into this because this is what I care about personally. At this point, you know, we pay very good prices. We have a good standards for paying our producers well. We pay some producers overly well for that quality, maybe the brand of their country. And I think for me, it's been almost I want it to be on the ground. You know, we talked earlier where we have people in Costa Rica and Nicaragua and different countries, and I'm gonna fly today to Canada and tomorrow to Guatemala. Mm-hmm. So I like being in the mix. And personally, honestly, I like it on a personal level. Like, I'm going to Guatemala in 2 days. I'm gonna have Pollo Campero, I'm gonna go meet with my producers. I love that. It gets to take me back home. And but I just wanted to put that out there that, you know, part of the podcast is in a way independent of the company,
right,
My Organics, but I want to give a platform to those that I believe are of the same mindset. And there aren't many, you know.
Right.
And I think the last few weeks have been very eye-opening for me of like, you know, interestingly, in a time when the fair trade movement is probably more necessary than ever, it's kind of pissed me off that I've seen the opposite. You know, I don't know if you guys can talk about it, but like this thing,
about
The Guardian.
About how we're upset, or
about The Guardian. That was such a bullshit piece of like, is fair trade dead because of direct trade? And it's like,
well, we're not going to be dead until the exception is not going to, like.
Well, you want to be dead, right? You
want
to be the
we
point
want everybody to do
if
fair trade.
If traders played fair and everybody did a fair price,
and
we wouldn't exist.
Exactly.
So. Please take us out.
Yeah.
Everybody.
We challenge it.
But do you think it's also like consumers get bored of like do they just want something cool and new? Is it cool and new to be like, we're direct trade with this and that? And is there a concern that like...
I think there's pressure socially to be better. Like,
to be woke
I actually,
in coffee,
yeah, I was actually, but not in general. Like, you want to be that, I was actually seeing a...
You want to be the next
documentary,
influencer.
Right. A documentary on Netflix yesterday, and they're talking about how, like, they're talking about Crazy Asians, the movie. How, like, finally, something, like, they're represented. And then one friend of his is telling him, like, well, you know, I didn't really like it originally, and then I went with my Asian friend, and he was represented, and I saw how happy he was. It's, like, right. The most condescending thing, right? So, like, why are we, like, it's this pressure that we now have to be so sensitive, and so, but it's not the right reason.
Well, and it's not functional either.
Exactly.
You know, it's like we had a meeting today about, you know, sometimes we lose our way a little bit in the branding, and we get caught up in the whole, like, hipster specialty thing.
Right, right.
And I'm like, you know what? We're a Hispanic specialty company. I want to be proud about that. Let's be in the festivals. Mm-hmm. And let's not just do it on Hispanic Heritage Month, which is the one month that people get to act like we matter. Like, let's matter year round. And it's the same thing to me of what you guys are dealing with, which is, you know, just because there's some new shiny thing over here that sounds cool and has better Instagram, you know, likability, or some, you know, influencer has a picture of themselves at a farm, that's not the systemic reality. And I, you know, the word systemic to me is so critical, because people don't see, and I would challenge that most people in my industry haven't gotten to the depths that I've gotten into, really understanding the human, the social, the economic, the financial. It's so systemic that poor farmers are kept poor on purpose. Mm-hmm. They're kept poor by, all you gotta do is look at who's making the most money in the last 6 months when the coffee market was in the, you know, 13-year lows. They're kept poor by those people and their.
But we also forget we come from colonization. Like, if you want to really go back into why the system,
completely.
And so we forget where we started and how we think, like, we stopped slavery. Well, we just had modern slavery, if you want to call it something. Like,
yeah.
Like, breaking those is going to take us longer than we actually realize. And people think also that by, like, it's like they pat themselves in the back because they do direct trade, but it's not traceable if it's not guaranteed, if somebody's not really thinking these ideas through, if we're not doing living wages and understanding the actual realities at the ground, then we're not going to break this. And we need to be willing to not only create awareness, but see our responsibility as consumers, as roasters, as traders, as farmers, in order to play in that. One of the things that really bothered me about the Guardian article is this thing where it's like almost like it's at the farmer level fault. And I was like, oh my God, they've never been down there for sure.
Right.
They think like, well, they have options. You're like, what are you talking about?
Well, I think that's more the mindset. And this is the thing that right now is like, I'm always pissed about something, and right now what I'm pissed about is just this whole thing of like, there's press about the depressed market, but now there's the new superheroes fixing it with quote unquote direct trade, but they're buying from the wealthy farmers, and so of course those farmers have options because they can go sell more cattle, they can go, like, you know,
they're
to the car dealerships that they own. Like, we're talking about wealthy people, and I think that's one of the things that drives me the craziest is when you see all these people that. You know, there's very few companies that are truly working with the marginalized producers and the marginalized co-ops and paying them a great price and doing it in a scaled out, sustainable way. And I think the others are savvy family estates and traders and exporters. No, I mean, I know of very large, multi-billion dollar large traders that have mills in Latin America, and then they have their micro mills and they're producing all the cool hipster stuff. That they bought for $1.10. Yeah. They bought it for $1.10, and guess what? You know, they're selling for $3.50, and now these, you know, little tiny roasters that bought two bags feel like they're special, but they're part of a major, what I think is just it's a fraud, you know, that is at the expense of the poor farmers. And it's actually good times right now for those people. The lower the market is, the better off these people are, because they get to look like rock stars.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I mean, for me, I feel like every time we turn a corner, like, I kind of got to the point where I felt like, okay, this is actually, it sounds crazy, but the sea market being where it is, it's kind of a good thing in a way. And in a way, it'll be a good thing that it doesn't shift, which I don't think it will, because I think Brazil and Vietnam are too focused on volume.
I was
going
to say, it's going to last a little longer.
But it should be a good thing, because it should make us recognize that there's shitty coffee that you can buy against the C Market, mm-hmm. and go at it and buy your canned ground, whatever it is that $1.20 a pound, go for it, and let the Brazilians still make money, which they do. Let the Vietnamese still make money, which they do. And then let's recognize that there's good quality and that there's sustainably
focused. But we need to educate the consumer for that. And the consumer in the other end needs to want to. So then how do we do for an article like The Guardian? They do, I feel, in part those articles because it makes a buzz and people read them. When it's the other way around, it doesn't get as much as a buzz when they're actually explaining these things. So that's why I think Steph was bringing up that partnership part, like aspect.
So do you think the article helped you because it creates the conversation?
In a bit, yeah.
I guess that's the most positive approach you can take to it.
Exactly. Right. Let's give it a very positive person. Let's give it the spin of like, okay, at least we're having a conversation about this, you know? But then why don't you put the other side?
Right.
That's kind of where we're fighting. And that's kind of our focus on let's create partnerships with people like Mayorga. Why that? Because our ethos aligns, because we're trying to help the same people.
And in a way, I think the good thing, I had a conversation with my staff today about, you know, I have serious ADD and it reflects in everything I do, including my business. And I think sometimes I even get caught up by the shiny thing with like the latte art and the pour overs and all that stuff that looks cool and fun. And I'm kind of back to, you know what, let's keep building what built this thing. I mean, 85% of my revenue is one product in this Cafe Cubano. Everywhere from Whole Foods to Costco to everybody, it's our number one. My revenue as a company is 1.2% online in my retail shop. It's insignificant. So my focus really needs to be in that bigger, you know, slice of pie. Why? Because it's actually got the more upside. And the example I gave is when somebody comes to me and says, you know, your coffee's not quality because you don't do geishas or you don't do, not, you know, right. I don't have that customer and I never will. When a customer emails me like I did 2 days or like they did yesterday and said, is your coffee Arabica?
Oh my God.
I'm like, yes, I'm going to have this customer for life.
Right.
Because number one, they're curious and they're inquisitive. And number two, they're at the very base of the pyramid of education for coffee. And I can, talk about it. Yes, it's Arabica, of course. It's also specialty grade, and that's what this means. I mean, we exchanged like 10 emails because everything I mentioned, she wanted to know more and about the batches and what does that mean and what, you know. For me, that's the opportunity to make an impact and difference. It's not about being cool to the people who think they're cool. It's actually doing things that a good person in a good company does to the people and the masses and the millions that are out there, you know, actually willing to make that little impact. And I think, you know, that's where things like the direct trade and, and we say direct trade, but you know what? We do it. You know,
right.
we actually write contracts with our farmers.
Right.
We actually, you know, we're involved. You guys, when you came in, you met the guy who we work in Mexico for our chia.
Right.
That's our world. So, you know, but I do get frustrated by, you know, just two words can mean 50 different things.
Yeah. Right.
And,
right.
I think we're seeing a lot of people use those two words to
pretend like things are changing. And it is one of our biggest challenges, is to create that awareness, to make sure the consumer understands that there's differences and that there's value on third-party certification because it can back it up.
Right.
And you need to get informed on that. And we're trying our best to get that information to you. But check your websites, check your actual labels. When you see a label, like, you check the nutritional facts. What are you consuming? What are you putting into your body? Then what's that brand doing for you and doing for the social?
All right, so let's clarify for the consumers, because there are companies, and I gotta be careful how I say it, but there are companies who will use fair trade.
Right.
And put it out there and everything.
Right.
And fair trade is just two words. So how do consumers know when they see the words fair trade and companies are touting themselves as being fair trade, and I use the word fair trade, but actually, no offense to you guys, but I use it as a way to say we pay at least whatever, the fair trade minimum you guys
establish. Because there's standards.
Right.
Right.
But we don't sell ourselves as a fair trade company.
Mm-hmm.
There are companies who sell themselves as fair trade. What should consumers look for specifically to know that they're actually getting fair trade certifying coffee
yeah.
or products of any sort?
So I think the simplest answer is you need a mind shift. And that is, and it's actually a simple one. Don't look for words, look for a logo.
Yeah.
And I know that that seems like, well, that's silly. But it's really not, because anybody can put words on a package. And like even like, you know, natural or
organic. Is used that way. Yeah.
But without the logos, it really, the consumer has no confirmation that it actually is there.
And I think, unfortunately, people want to believe. Do you guys watch the movie Elf?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in New York and he walks by the coffee shop and it says world's best coffee.
Right.
He's congratulations. Like, congratulations. Like, that's consumerism, right?
Right,
it's like,
right.
If you put on a bag, people think, and the sad thing is, consumers want to believe that there's some magic government entity
that
making sure that everything, if anything, the government writes packaging laws so that they can be very, like, made with and, you know, mm-hmm. contains, like, are good avenues for companies to really, you know, one of the greatest things I saw was a juice that said made with 100% juice. What people don't realize is made with is the disclaimer that it has up to 5% of
right,
something.
Yeah.
So if you make something with up to 5% of 100% of something,
yeah.
that means up to 5% of this product is juice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when a consumer reads, it's like made with 100% juice.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, and so for me, that's like the biggest challenge too, is that we can't be lazy either as consumers.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's funny because one of my biggest challenges, and I take it on, and maybe because I'm, you know, maybe I need to rethink my priorities, because I like the challenge. I like when people are like, well, you guys are making claims. I'm like, ask me anything.
Right.
You know what? Let's get one of my producers on the phone. You know, let me here's his information. Email him. I like that. But you know what? It's a lot of heavy lifting. And we've grown too much as a company now to the point where it's just like, you know, like I said, I'm going to Guatemala, and, you know, we're everywhere. And it's because we have to, A, make sure that what we're doing is above board, but we also have to make sure that what we're being told is above board. You know, and I mentioned to you guys some incidents where we hear things that don't add up. We have to fly down to Latin America, we have to sit down with people, and we have to ask questions, and, like, it's, I should be selling. I should be roasting, I should be
right.
growing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's kind of where we come. You might have
I don't know,
space.
I feel like I just gave you all the, like, ammunition to convince me to work in the
yes.
ice.
That's where we come, because you might have even the space to do that. But if we think about companies who are starting, who are trying to do the right thing, and who can't, or who are too large to go there, or care enough
mm-hmm.
as a company, or even if they're not owned by the, like, you know, they're owned by corporations, they're public, then they can't make those decisions of flying to Guatemala and discussing these things.
Yeah.
So we offer them a way to help. A nonprofit, it's not in our interest other than to help the farmer.
Right, and you're not involved in the transaction.
I'm not involved in the transaction. We're just mediators in order to not only guarantee sustainability, you also build a relationship with these people. And again, like I think I mentioned, direct trade doesn't have to be against fair trade. You can do direct trade and do it as a fair trade transaction. And that way you have guarantees and you have certification of how much you're paying, where it's coming from. It's not necessarily a thing that goes against each other. It's actually, it could go together.
You could also do direct trade and be a piece of crap that takes advantage.
That's
of
what I'm saying.
I mean, the reality is,
so it doesn't
just
make
a direct relationship doesn't mean it's a good relationship.
And it doesn't mean you're helping the farmer.
Right.
It just means you're doing some trade with somebody directly, which sometimes it's the producer, sometimes it's a trader, sometimes it's an exporter, and you don't have a way to check again.
Yeah.
We do that work for you.
It's funny. Our industry is just, I feel like the bar is set so low. It's sad.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
In one of my podcasts, I talk about, like, when you walk by a national change and they have a line of ethically sourced product, I'm like,
right. What does
wow,
that mean?
How is, and like, why are we bragging about being ethical? Like, honestly, like, that the bar is so low that we're now, like, patting ourselves on the back because we're not, like, completely taking advantage of the poorest people in the world.
Right.
Literally, we're in an industry where the wealthiest in the world work with the poorest in the world. And it really should be an uplifting opportunity for, you know, the impoverished, and it's the opposite. And then people, companies, use the fact that they're not completely just, like, taking advantage 100% of the time of producers as, like, this great thing. Like, look how great we are. We're being ethical.
Right.
And even that, I don't even know what that
right.
means.
Right.
So, yeah, it's It's a lot of fun.
Well, this is our everyday. That's kind of the conversation.
This is why I have no friends. I was on the phone with a buyer. The other day, I was on the phone with a big, big buyer, and she trusts them. You know, she asked me a lot of questions, and, you know, I was like giving her all the load, honey. And I was like, you know, this is why I have no friends. I'm like, I'm just like, I'm not like the ray of sunshine that's going to come in and be like, because the reality is, I started this. You know, I'm 46 now. I started this because of what I was seeing from when I was four, my first memories. I mean, I tell people all the time, my first memory in Guatemala was at a market. Lady and her kid and her son. My son was about my age. They came and asked for money. Literally, the boy was looking at me. The woman was in front of my mom. We're walking out with bags full of food. They're begging for, like, a penny. And I was too little. I'm like, wait, how does this happen? Like, I couldn't understand. I'm like,
why doesn't his mom just go into the grocery store?
Yeah, just the grocery store's right there. Like, and I started seeing that so young. And, you know, I got into this. I mean, I went to Georgetown. I was going to be a big Wall Street guy and make all this money. I was like, I can't. I got to go make a difference. And I got to be honest with you. I think farmers are worse off now than they were when I started.
For sure.
I think they're more marginalized. I think that they're more removed from the market. I think the big trade houses are wealthier. I think they're more vertically integrated, which is right. The most dangerous thing. Yeah. I think these downtimes are booms for the big traders. They're taking over land. They're buying farms. They're getting coffee cheap. They're investing all those profits into more infrastructure for aggregating. You know, so I guess, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to get. My point is, but it bothers me. And right. It bothers me not to see, you know, the real impactful movements get, like, you guys, that article should have been about the fact that fair trade is more important than ever and more relevant than ever.
And yes, I mean, we're not the silver bullet. We're not the only answer. We're not the only thing companies should be doing, right? Like, but we are trying to change. And we, on the contrary, should be, like, people should be joining us. We all want to do the same thing, right? I mean, I come from kind of, I feel the same background as you. I come from Venezuela. My family are actual producers. And I think of, like, what my grandfather did. He only went until second grade. His had holes in his shoes. And he got to the point where he owned his farms. So then I think, like, could somebody right now in Venezuela do that? And, I mean, Venezuela is actually in, like, a very deep crisis. But even other countries in Latin America who are doing much better than Venezuela. Can somebody now with a second grade education go and build and end up owning their farms?
They can't.
Send their kids to college? They can't.
There's no way. I mean, and the ones that can and do are the ones that are third generation and have money, and their mom is like, hey, do you want to run the coffee farm or the cattle business or the hotel business? Which one do you want?
Right.
You know, it's a different dynamic. And, you know, I think those are the ones that are thriving now. And I think, you know.
And that's kind of where, like you, I felt like, no, I need to get involved in something, in a movement that actually is focused on getting those farmers to have those opportunities. And that's kind of why I believe so deeply in fair trade, because I see the results on the ground. We go to the places, we see how these things really make a difference on people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
You see them improve their housing, you see them improve, their kids are getting to use computers, are getting to, so, like, it's really rewarding, and it's kind of what keeps us motivated every day to have those other conversations about somebody telling you, well, but I can get it 20 cents cheaper. And you're like, oh, but you're not doing the right thing. How do we get you to do the right thing? And I think in part it's gonna take every piece of the chain to be part of this conversation and to help us educate the consumer. Because at the end, that's what makes the movement. The person putting in the money when they buy that cup of coffee, when they buy that chocolate bar, making the decision to be, I guess the word is ethical, but
I think it's human. I think we've lost humanity.
Right.
You know, I think that's the biggest thing. I don't see how people don't realize the human impact of their decisions, and
that's
the
most
disheartening thing. Yeah, it's sad. Now, you touched on chocolate, and we don't have much time, but to me, cacao, oh my God, talk about a mess.
I know.
That coffee looks like it's light
years
ahead. I mean,
there's a lot to go into. You want to pick one topic, or?
All right, I got one for you. Ready?
Okay.
We talked a little bit about it, but define what fine cacao is.
Oh, you're just going to throw a big one out. You know, I'll take something from NCA, so not your not the coffee, but the Confectioners Association. They're trying to do it by price point.
Right.
And so I think it's a good starting point. And so you've got your conventional chocolate, and then you've got what we would call a premium chocolate, and then you have your fine cocoa chocolate.
And how do you... And I think it was more of a loaded question because...
Yeah, I know.
I think there's about 5,000 different answers to it.
Yeah.
My perspective is the real answer is it's chocolate that people pay a lot of money for. From what I've seen, it's not necessarily a product that's been, you know, qualitatively distinguished, nor is it a product that has been established to have practices wherein the producer cultivates it or curates it into a better quality and gets paid more for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from my perspective, the fine cacao movement is about the chocolatier more than the grower. And I'm trying, you know, and I'm half asking out of curiosity and half asking because I literally have gotten a different answer from coffee cacao growers to chocolatiers. And I think it's dangerous because I think that we have to put the quality standards in place because I think confusion is great for traders that don't want to help farmers. I think definitive standards are critical. So what do you see as like the opportunity within the fine cacao movement, which has, you know, it's to me a little bit like the hipster coffee movement where it's got a lot of words going around but not necessarily trading power. I mean, I heard a stat for fine cacao on the imports that's like nothing. I mean, the volume was just like irrelevant.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, just I could do that in a month.
I mean, if you think about it in terms of like a stat and just think about chocolate in general, I mean, 60% of the world's cocoa is coming out of West Africa, and I could only tell you two co-ops,
right,
that would even be at the level to be able to produce a fine cocoa. Now there are a lot of projects and a lot of efforts to make that different, but right now if you're talking of like a fine quality cocoa, it's tough.
And it takes partnership. You
know,
we have what I think is the first ever a scoring guide that goes towards what the SCA cupping guide with scoring, and we've done it. We have no vested interest. If anything, I'm kind of shooting myself in the foot because now I'm going to have to pay more.
Yeah, you're taking on another project.
Yes, and I'm going to pay more for cacao now because I've now been like, oh, whoa, this is like 80 cup, 90 cup.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to pay more for it, but mm-hmm. I'm trying to establish a new standard.
And I don't know if it's the same in coffee, but with cacao, there's been a few incredible studies that have shown that the tree itself brings on so much of its terroir, like wine. It's more in like for that and the fine quality that you can get out of other things that you're growing on a plot.
Right.
That's the part that excites me about fine cacao because you have diversification that's necessary.
And that's actually contributing
towards the product. And it's profitable, right?
Yeah.
So there's different terms, and the one that I've seen a lot in presentations recently is called agroforestry.
Mm-hmm.
Which
is kind of the...
Yeah.
A functional permaculture
model,
which I'm a big fan of permaculture, but it's not as
yeah.
you know, business friendly for actual trade. But
you have to also think that the cocoa tree is just so temperamental as well. And it takes at least, I think, 5 to 6 years to get the pot.
And there's so many hybrids and some that just happen on their own. And like it's kind of this wild, which I think is very cool.
It is.
Because it's about as natural as you can get for an agricultural product. But...
Yeah.
It's
but that
a bit
part
of a wild
excites
card.
Me, that like the fine cocoa world, I think there is huge opportunity for cocoa farmers that they can diversify within the same plot of land. It is
I
not
agree,
a
totally.
Single crop mentality.
And I
anymore.
Hope a lot of my coffee farmers pull out their coffee and plant cacao.
come on, I'm still here, okay?
No offense.
I'm still
sorry
here.
Sorry for leaving you out
that
of here.
That comment only helped 50% of my audience. But it's true. Number one, climate change.
Yeah.
If you don't believe in climate change, go to a coffee growing country.
Right.
And ask where the coffee was grown 50 years ago,
right.
And they're going to drive you way down a mountain to a lower region
right.
that was the coffee region 50 years ago and is now a desert.
Yeah.
And 10 years ago, it was another town, and like everyone was like looking for a higher ground. And cacao at least will have more tolerance, and you know, it requires a lot of water and things, but it is a good alternative. And no offense to coffee or cacao, I care less about those products than I do about the people that depend on them.
Oh, right. So do
and
we.
So for me,
for us,
the same. I'm joking. But I also, like, people mess with me because I also, when I go to Origin or I'm talking to producers, I'm talking about, like, diversify. A lot of them are doing, like, honeys and this, and, like, where can you get more money? And people are like, well, wait, are you a coffee person? Or I'm like, if I want him to keep growing coffee and good quality coffee, then he needs to get a decent income from somewhere.
Amen. I mean, so, my competitors have gone to my customers and told them that I'm not even a coffee company anymore because I sell chia. And I'm like, well, guess what? My coffee farmers are financially more sound because of their chia.
And then,
and they'll be that way with cacao. And I got news for you. I'm importing beans, black beans, like that you eat on your tortillas. I'm bringing in, I'm going to pack it, I'm going to ship it. And why? Because coffee farmers grow beans because during the lean months, which is an embarrassment of a term that should never be used in any industry, they grow beans to either for themselves and to sell to El Salvador. You know, they're not even exporting it. They're going to make 50% more by selling it to us and us creating a market with their brand and recognizing them as producers, which makes them better coffee farmers. Right. You know, and I think...
I agree completely.
I think if there's one thing I can count on that I'll be right on in the future is the fact that if coffee farmers don't diversify when and where they can, they don't have a sustainable livelihood. Some have the scale not to need it, but if you're a smallholder farmer, find the money wherever you can, not at the expense of coffee, but enhancing your ability to, you know, cultivate.
And we were talking earlier, I don't think it was actually on the podcast, about your living costs are going to be your living costs regardless if you own 1 hectare or 1,000 hectares. So if your cost to live is X, and even if you have your coffee farm tip top, every little corner has a coffee plant and it's booming.
That's it.
You need to diversify in order to make that plot of land make you enough money to cover your living income. Because coffee, and especially with the current market, will not.
And on the flip side, the worst thing that pisses me off when the industry says, producers need to manage their costs.
Ooh.
And to me, that's so, like, first of all, it's coming out of the mouths of companies that love a 25% net income.
Right.
So that their investors and shareholders and, you know, they can live a big life. And like, okay, well, until you manage your costs to the lowest common denominator, you have no, you know, you have to deal with that yourself. But secondly, you're talking about people who have nowhere to go for cost savings. They've saved the most they can because they've never had the opportunity to have to save. They're surviving.
And people don't realize that also a lot of their things are controlled. So one of the reasons why we like to help them get into co-ops is so that they can negotiate on volume.
I love that, yeah.
Because
it's scale and
it's,
they have leverage.
They can, exactly. If not, they have no leverage. Because we forget that most of the times they have to work with this one exporter who provides the services for them and then control the freight costs, the fertilizing costs, the seed costs. So we talked, right, we talk about how they have options, but if all their costs are managed by their exporter, who they're selling and who also sets the price that they're buying their coffee at, then what options are they really having? Which is why we like to organize them so they have leverage, so they have a way to negotiate, and they have options to actually say, no, we can find our seeds through another source that's going to give us better money.
No, that's a big.
Right.
I mean, I think I talked about it in one of my podcasts about that too, where, and a lot of these producers have Stockholm syndrome where they feel like they're like, well, we can't, you know, I've forced some producers to be like, no, I'm not going to work with that mill because XYZ, they're like, they've been helping me for generations. I'm like, how much better is your life after 30 years of working with these people? It's been kind of the same, if not worse. Like, they're not helping you. You know, let's take a look at another option and see what, you know.
And that's why we've seen a lot of co-ops who then end up setting up their own export companies.
Yeah.
And they help themselves out that way. And also create revenue because they start helping. And
they provide services.
Exactly.
That's what I'm a big fan of, kind of the outgrower model from the farmers and the co-ops themselves. You know, where they actually then get their mill, get their exporting license, and bring others up with them and get the colonizers out of there and get them in, you know, their facilities to go away.
And sometimes, I mean, I hate talking like it's one part of the chains is the bad guy and the other one. Because at the end, we all have a certain responsibility with the entire chain, but I will, because sometimes we forget the actual things that they do provide, which is that risk management on the shipments, the testing, this whole guarantees that they also give, and the other side of the transaction. I know you're looking at me totally, like you don't agree.
The traders are the bad guys. I don't care what anyone says. And it's not all traders.
Right.
I think there's certain ones that have been around for generations, and that literally, I mean, it's creepy. You go there and like, this is modern day colonization left over from when these same trade groups established trading routes from the old world to the new world. I mean, it's still there.
And I agree with you.
I can say more things than
right.
others can usually. So.
No, but in total honesty, I do think we don't realize that there's also a lot of small roasters and small companies which we want them to do a more fair trade, and they will need a trader. They don't have the volumes in order to not do so. Also, if you want these people to have varieties of coffee and source coffees from Asia and Africa, like it's. We do see the value in having that part of the chain still be there. But again, that's kind of
how it's done. And
right,
it's
exactly.
Been done.
And how that's why we certify every piece of the supply chain in order to guarantee that everybody's playing their part.
Right.
And going back to the Guardian, we'll be dead when that happens without us.
Well, that's what I say. I want my farmers to be like, you know what, Martin, we're not going to sell to you because we found somebody to pay us more, to treat us better, to actually be engaged with us year round, to help us with loans, to help us with diversification.
Right.
Like,
right.
If you find my replacement, great, because there's been plenty of others that we would love to work with. Mm-hmm. And that means that you now are moving up the ladder into, you know, a better situation for yourself. So where do people find you guys? Not you personally.
It's like, I don't want to
no
give
stalkers.
My address here. What are you talking about?
Where do they learn more about your group, what you guys are doing, and find products that you're certifying?
Well, you can go to our website, which is usually the one that has most of the information. It's www.fairtradeamerica.net. There's the Fair Trade International. You can also Google anything about CLAC, which is our Latin America producer network. We have at Fair Trade Mark US. That's us.
That's Instagram.
Our Instagram and Twitter. And it's supposed to be Mark Us.
Oh, okay.
Like, it's a person.
Got it.
You can find information there. I'm Isabella Pacheco, and you can search me if you have any questions about coffee, tea, and wine. And
then I'm Stephanie Westell, who does mostly chocolate and sugar. And then I'm doing actually a cocoa journey through Instagram right now. Through different lenses of cocoa throughout the supply chain. So if you want to check it out on Instagram, it's at Travel Puzzles, but spelled P-U-Z-Z-E-L-S.
Interesting. All right. And we'll definitely talk about chocolate because we're going to be doing our first transactions with chocolate and with cacao and then processing in Miami. So I think we can start the conversation on certification there.
Don't look at
it's
me like
starting
that.
Point. It's
Don't
a starting
look at
point.
Me like that.
And then for us, you can find us at Myorga Organics on Instagram, and then just Google Myorga Organics. And, email me, martin@myorgaorganics.com, and usually I end this with Nikki, but he's not here, so Nikki says hello. Bye.